your control. Just say that.
Welcome to Portland Eye in Your Control.
Yeah.
One, two, three. Welcome to Portland Eye in Your Control. Matt's here.
That was great.
Welcome back to the second half of our conversation with Matt Hanifin. I'm Brandon Conway, the board president of the Creative Music Guild. The last time Ben and I were talking with Matt, we just got onto so many great topics. Last time we talked mostly about Matt's background, kind of his musical upbringing and how he first started playing percussion. In this episode, we'll start to hear about how he approaches music and sort of his journey into his current setup and his current aesthetic. It's really fascinating to hear Matt talk about this journey he's been on. And let's just get back into that conversation.
It was very chaotic, my early musical life. You know, a lot of chaos going on. My musical background is not rock and roll. My musical background is not jazz. It's not classical music. It's this very windy path that came through, you know, industrial music, a little improv, you know, Brazilian music, a little detour to this northern India, you know. And you know, then it sort of settled in the Middle East for a while. You can't see this, but I'm doing these hand gestures that look like waves. It sort of settled in the Middle East for a long time, and then it started making sense. It took that long for me to really start making sense of what I wanted to do musically. And it's still, I'm still trying to make sense of it. I did the Iranian thing, the Persian thing for years, and then started improvising. And there was also the concept of, like, when you don't come out of rock and roll, you don't come out of jazz, you don't come out of a drum set. Mm-hmm. I never learned to play drum set. So my formal training was all on hand drums. So not only did I not want to play a drum set because I didn't necessarily know how to play a drum set, you know, because I wasn't using my feet, you know, I didn't have any concept of using my feet to play bass drum or hi-hat, but I also didn't like the sound because I was used to my fingers hitting the drums, not a stick. You know, your sticks, you get a very defined woody sound. Fingers is very soft. So I had to find a way of creating not only a kit that I could use for improv music, but also how to play it in a way that would make a sound that I liked. Because if you have, you know, it's one thing to play a hand drum, you know, a single hand drum with your hands. You're exciting the membrane with your fingers. But if you're also wanting to add, you know, bells, triangles, cymbals, you can't necessarily play them with your fingers. So I didn't have the option of just playing with my hands. So I had to find a way of using sticks. You know, and if I had gone into classical music, I would have known that, oh yeah, mallets. You know, there's all these different mallets you can use. I had to figure that out myself. So I finally, you know, found the mallets that I liked that made like a finger-like sound, and worked from there. And it took, you know, it's all been this very long evolutionary process, and it's still going on. When I moved from New York to Portland in 2006, and when I first got here, I was still doing what I did then. It was this. I had this idea that, you know, if you're an improviser, you have to be prepared to play with anybody, whether it's a jazz guy or whomever. You know, you have to be prepared to do that. So you have to have certain instruments that you can, you know, can be adaptable to those sounds. You have to be able to do this. And then my son was born, then my daughter, and I had to take a real hiatus from playing for a while. I was still practicing, but. And so my time constraint, my time was very constrained at that point. And I realized that I don't have to do that. You have kids. You probably know. You get focused down. And you're like, yeah, I've only got 10 minutes. What do I really want to do? Mm-hmm. So that philosophy started getting into music. I have got very little time for music. What do I really want to do? And I realized what I really wanted to do is I wanted to play very quiet, very spacious. I didn't want to make any sound that I didn't need to make. I only wanted to make the sounds that were really important. And for a percussionist in improv, I guess for anybody in improv, but it seems like specific, especially for percussionists. Percussionists in improv tend to play a lot. There's a lot of scuttling around, doing rubbing and scraping. And I just decided I didn't want that anymore. I didn't want any of that. So I stopped doing all of it. And I started concentrating on just doing like the one sound that makes sense. You know, if I do a whole performance and could get away with just making one sound that was perfect, that's what I wanted to do. And that's led me to all, basically what I've been working on the past few years. And it's good. I feel better about what I'm doing now than about pretty much anything I've ever done musically before, except the Persian music, which still is such an important thing for me.
What are you working on now then?
So a lot of solo stuff. I started because my theory is very weak. I'm not big on, I wish I knew. I'm actually going to start studying with a classical percussionist this year to try to bone up on that. But because of that, I started looking into a lot of graphic and tech scores and seeing what I could do with that.
Like the piece of the ISP?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we did, that was with dancer Kat McMillan. We did three text pieces by Yoko Ono. And that's my favorite performance I've ever done. I think I loved that. Thank you for the opportunity.
It was one of the best things I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Really amazing. Wow.
Thank you. So I started looking at that, and that fulfilled multiple things for me because not only did it allow me to start thinking of compositionally within my skill set as far as not being very good reader, but also this is like a few other like logistical things, like if I was trying to play a lot of notated classical scores, they would be asking for things that I can't do. I cannot play marimba. I don't know how. And I don't have one, and probably not going to be buying one anytime soon. So working with text and graphic scores, I get to do the orchestration myself to the instruments that are appropriate. And not only is that appropriate for what I have, like physically what instruments I have, but also what I want to hear. So I could, I could find text and graphic scores that seem to lend themselves to a sound that I want to make, but that push me in a direction that I wouldn't have gone naturally as an improviser. As an improviser, me personally, you fall into these things like, oh, I did that thing again. You get through a performance, you're like, oh, I did thing A, B, and K. I don't really want to do that. I didn't mean to do those, but I fell back into those patterns that I usually do. So doing the text and graphic scores, it's really pushed me out of that. And I've been very grateful for that because I was definitely falling into some serious habits. I remember getting to the, I remember doing performances and I'd have that moment where I go, oh man, I've used all my tricks. What can I do? I can't do anything. I've used all my tricks. I just have to use one of the tricks again. And that's a terrible feeling. It's the worst. Yeah. Cause there's, you feel like a fake. You feel like there's just nothing, you feel like you're trying to trick people. And I didn't want to feel that. So that's my main thing that I'm working on now is those. I've got a whole page of pieces that I want to work on. One thing that I'm pretty excited about, Doug Terrio, who's an instrument builder and guitar player here in Portland, is building me three recreations of these things called sondals. They were echolocation devices that Alvin Lucier used for his piece Vespers. And they don't make them anymore. They made them for a couple of years in the 70s, I think. So he's going to build me. Doug, if you're listening, you still have to build this for me. He's going to build this for me, and we're going to do that somewhere. We're going to do that piece, the Vespers. Me and I've roped in Tim DeRoche and Lauren Chassie.
So you'll have it ready by ISP 2016?
I hope to do it this winter. But if you want us to do it, then we can do that.
let's talk more about that.
Okay. So we're planning to do that. And this is the first performance of what I'm hoping will be a regular thing. We're going to do that and probably the Christian Wolf piece Stones, which is basically play rocks. that's basically the score. He goes on, but it's try not to break anything, I think, is another one of the instructions. But that and one other piece, we're not sure which yet. So that's one of the projects I've got in the works. And I have a duo with oboist Catherine Lee. We've been working together for 2 years now, I think. Put a CD in the world. I won't say we put it out because it hasn't gone anywhere, as far as I know, except in our basements so far. But it came out really well. I had been wanting to work with an oboe player for years and just really hadn't been able to track anybody down. And I found her through you. Actually, you sent out, she played at the Outset series, your Outset series. And I said, oboe player. And I figure how many Catherine Lee oboe Portland could there be? So I Googled her and found her. Want to play? Yeah, sure. Okay. And that was that. Those are my main projects right now. My day-to-day, I'm a writer by profession, and I end up taking five breaks over the course of the day to practice music because it helps me focus for writing as well. But a lot of my practice is still on the Persian drum. So one of these days, I got to figure out what to do with that in a new music kind of setting. I don't know what yet. Because it's a very defined sound, and when I hear it, I think, oh, Persian music. It's Persian music. And no matter what you do with it, it sounds like Persian music. So I haven't figured out how to abstract it yet to a real new music kind of sensibility. Although I've got a couple of scores that were written for it, one of which I definitely want to try out at some point here in a performance. But I haven't had time to work on it yet.
And that's this here, this drum.
So I should play that at some point.
That would be interesting, especially since your kit is based off of.
Exactly. Yeah. It's funny because I didn't realize. I'm 51 years old, and it took me until about 3 months ago to realize that was what I was doing. That I was trying to get that sound in the kit. It sounds ridiculous. You'd think I would realize this over the course of the last 20 years, but I didn't. And it struck me one day, like, that's what I've been doing. Because every time I'd think, okay, I need a lower drum. I need a drum in this pitch range. And I'd go and I'd try out this, I'd try out that, I'd try out all these different heads, and I'd end up customizing them. I'd end up cutting up things and trying to get a very particular tonality, a very particular timbre out of the thing. And I, it didn't occur to me that I was trying to recreate something else. I was just going like, no, that's not it. That's not it. That's not right. What is it? Oh, that's it. So yeah, I mean, it makes me sound like an idiot, but yeah, it took years. It's probably a good thing that now I'm realizing why I'm doing things, you know, why I'm interested in certain sounds. Something else I was thinking about earlier was, somewhere in my mind, the whole time that I've been, from the time I started playing music, I think I actually was looking for a couple of specific kinds of sounds and didn't know what I was looking for. Necessarily, like I knew that you could make a sound, you could make that sound somehow, but I didn't know how. And as I was listening to other people's music, I'd catch little glimmers of it, like, yeah, that's kind of like what I'm looking for, and follow it more, and like that, yeah, that's a little bit more like it. And so there's like very, very like, basically, all I want out of music is I want an incredibly rich, but not necessarily overwhelmingly loud, drony kind of sound, or a sustained sound. Let's say a sustained sound, and I want very beautiful individual percussive attacks. That's it. That's my music right there. That's all I want. And I want those things to fit together in a way that is pleasing to me.
That's amazing.
I've been piecing together little things here and there over the years. I studied for a couple of years, I can't remember how long actually, a year or two in the late 80s with Lamont Young in New York. And at the time when I started, and I hate to admit this, but when I started studying with him, I had no idea who he was. I had gone to an Indian music concert by his Indian music teacher, Pandit Pranath, and Lamont and his wife Marion were playing tambora and doing backing vocals, and there was a flyer there that said, care to study Indian classical singing? Call us. So I did, because I thought this was an amazing, you know, Pandit Pranath was the greatest musician ever. So I started studying with Lamont, and I gradually realized, oh, he's important. Oh, I get it. Man. And then I started listening to his music, and I'm like, it was kind of like looking into the sun. You know, it was an astounding experience, and still is. When I found his music, it was there's nothing better. I mean, that's it for me. Like I listen to his music almost every day. So like trying to get some of that kind of feeling in that influence, like the sustains that I was talking about, a sustaining depth of beautiful sound punctuated by some percussive material.
Mm-hmm. And that sustained sort of sound is sort of, you know, not what you associate with percussion instruments.
No, and right, I know.
Challenge, right?
And that actually, that went, getting back to the Yoko Ono pieces we did at your festival, that was my whole point with that. There's hardly anything but sustaining sounds in all three of those pieces. It was all legato, as little definition as possible between, like, there was one piece where I had to switch from one gong to another gong, and I worked on that for days. I mean, like, solid days, just trying to get it completely invisible. Like, if you had your eyes closed, you wouldn't notice. And there was it's quite a pitch difference between the two. You know, one was a pretty large gong, and one was fairly small, and getting between those two without any noticeable differentiation was such a challenge, and it was a beautiful thing to work on. Yeah. It was tough.
Yeah, when did you start bringing gong into your palette?
It's funny, I bought one ages ago, like probably 20 years ago, and it sat in my apartment in New York, and I never brought it in, and I never used it on a gig. It just, because it was big, I just bought this huge gong. I get it was by accident. I think I bought one on eBay. I bought a little Korean gong on eBay at some point. I don't know when it was. And it turned out to be a really good Korean gong. And I started using that. And Korean gongs are, well, this was it's called a Kwangori gong. And it has a bit of a rising pitch to it, a little bent, but it's really controllable. And you can even like grab the edge of it a little bit and bend it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very flexible instrument and also really rich, like a lot of harmonics in there. So I can credit that particular gong, which apparently was, there were Olympics in Korea sometime in the last 20 years, right?
That sounds familiar.
There were, yes. I don't remember what year. But that gong was apparently like a part of a package that was given to VIPs or something. Mm. It came in this box, like, welcome to the Olympics.
Here's a gong.
Yeah. Huh. But it was an excellent gong. You know, I've gone to, there's a Korean shop in LA that I've gone to look for more of those. And that's still the best one I've ever heard. Mm. It's completely by accident. So, yeah. So, I've been using those a lot. Especially lately, the Yoko Ono pieces again were scored almost completely for gongs. These three pieces were the water pieces. I don't know if she calls them the water pieces, but one of them is called Water Piece, Fall 1963. One's Water Piece, Spring 1964, and the third one is also called Water Piece, Spring 1964, and they're each one line of text. And like one of them is listen to the sound of the water underground. One of them is steal the moon from a lake with a bucket. Keep stealing until there is no more moon on the water. I love that one. And the third one just says water. One word, water. So I figure, you know, how do you translate? How do you do water? And there's only a few ways you can do water with percussion instruments, or at least the only a few ways I can do it. I'm sure a marimba player would have a great take on this. So gong seemed the way to go, and I worked on that for 4 months, I think. I mean, just solid. That's all I did musically for four months was work on those pieces, and it ended up being like really amazingly structured. Like the first piece used two instruments, the second piece used three instruments, the third piece used four instruments. So there was a build in the complexity as it went along. But it was almost all gongs and a very large bass drum that I rubbed on to get a water, like a wind on the water kind of sound. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where I'm going with this now. I lost the train of what you asked me.
I asked about gongs.
Gongs are great. Gongs are the most amazing things ever. I get most of mine now from, there's a guy in Nebraska, Omaha. No, not Omaha. Lincoln, Nebraska. Gongs Unlimited. And they're great because they will, you call them up, you say, I want one of these gongs, but I got to hear these things first. And they'll make you a little video and they'll demonstrate all of them. And, you know, they'll put out four of the same one and you'll get to hear exactly. I listen to them along with recordings of all my other ones to match the harmonics. Wow. and the pitches, but I got to stop doing that. I'm bankrupting myself. yeah.
Well, you know what I was thinking was you play with Catherine, mm-hmm. and she's a doctorate in oboe.
Yeah, she does.
And you also play with Lauren. I don't know Lauren's musical background, but he doesn't play instruments, mm-hmm. largely. And then when I've seen, he plays sand and paper.
Sand, rocks, and, yeah. paper, wood, yeah.
And I guess I was wondering about your communication with Catherine, mm-hmm. where you two meet, because she comes from like the most Western, you know, sort of training from the outside. I mean, her own take on that, but like from the outside looking in, it's like incredibly formal,
yeah.
Almost no Western musical background, never mind training.
Yeah.
And then Lauren, who I don't know where he comes from, but what he plays is...
He started as a drummer.
Yeah, so but what he plays now is not discernible as music to most people, or as instruments to most people. So those are... It seems of a piece when you listen, but also just knowing the three people a little bit.
Uh-huh. It's funny, it's in those situations. I mean, in general, I actually find that I play best with classical players. Hmm. Like everybody, all of my best associations were with classical, but most of them have been with classical musicians. And I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's I do know why that is, because they have such a they have the capacity, I guess, to have such a richness of their tone. I just, the tone is really what gets me. They're not rushing, you know, they're not rushing to fill up the space with as many notes as they can necessarily, you know? Especially an oboe player. I mean, oboe players basically, you know, can just play one long note and what else do you need to do? So with her, it's funny with her. We played for a while before she realized that I had no background whatsoever to speak of, and that made me feel good. I had to say like, I can't read that. I have no idea how to read that. Because we talked about doing a Cage piece. We probably still will do it at some point. And I said, I presented it. I said, I know you can sight read this. I cannot. But I can figure it out eventually, so we should do this. And she said, oh, really? So with Lauren and other people like that, a lot of other percussionists say, because he's definitely, I mean, he's a percussionist really at heart. He, you know, maybe he'd disagree, but my take on him is that he comes from a percussive sensibility, a lot of textural work. So him, it's just like, you know, it's playing with another percussionist. That's how it feels to me. Like he's basically doing the same thing I'm doing with a completely different approach. But we have the same language. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty easy. My challenge with him is that I have to try not to be hokey. Because I'm using traditional instruments. Oh. So there are associations with traditional instruments. There are no associations with letting sand drift through your fingers onto a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it is. What a drum is when you hit it, it's a drum. And you hit it, you know, different people are going to say, oh, that's a drum. That's like that drum in that song. Or that's like that drum that they use in this kind of music. You don't get that with his thing. So I have to be very careful. And the last performance we did, I was really disappointed with myself in listening back to it, that I was not performing up to a level of, mutability. It was too much there was too much defined in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, it wasn't natural enough. It didn't feel natural enough. It didn't feel like I was giving it enough space. I mean, it was a good lesson. I have to go, but we haven't played since, and we have to, because now that, you know, I've learned that lesson, maybe I'll do it better next time. And we have talked about recording too. We have no plans necessarily to do that yet. That's a goal. To try not to be, I don't even know what word I'm looking for. Obvious, not to be pigeonholable, not to be, you want to make a sound that doesn't sound like anything else, or that sounds like, or that could sound like anything. Mm. Yeah. On Facebook a week or two ago, Pauline Oliveros had a question like, what's the sound that makes you happy? And I didn't actually respond with what I was thinking because it would have taken too much explanation. But it, the best sound I ever heard in my life, I was in the Caribbean one time, and there was, it was a beach, but there was tide coming in over these little, it was very shallow, you know, half an inch. Tide was coming in over these little pebbles and bits of shell, and it was rolling them across each other. And that's it. I mean, that was like the best sound I ever heard in my life. And how great would it be to make a sound like that? And because it sounds like the world, but it doesn't sound like, and it sounded musical, but it didn't sound like any music you ever heard necessarily. Not any music that I ever heard. That would be nice to be able to make something like that.
Creative Music Guild is an all-volunteer nonprofit whose mission is to support and promote creative and improvised music. Check us out at www.creativemusicguild.org, also on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud.